Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. The final speaker in the guest and lecture series is the recently elected, brilliant political figure from the state of Minnesota, the Honorable Senator Eugene J. McCarthy. Senator McCarthy.
Mr. Chairman, members of the faculty and the student body, Georgetown University, and ladies and gentlemen. I was somewhat taken aback at the title which I found in the program. I've had a week or two to consider it, but the task ahead for the United States, which seemed rather comprehensive, and I've narrowed it down really to what I consider to be the task ahead for the government, not necessarily the federal government, although my principal emphasis will be upon problems which do concern the federal government, which at least concern it in some measure. But the somewhat more comprehensive objective I have is to discuss the general problems and the task ahead for a government in the United States. I suppose that as a man recently elected, true of many public office holders in the United States, we prefer to talk about the task ahead rather than the work which has been performed. Now, this is generally true in the course of a campaign, at least, to somehow indicate what is likely to happen, or at least to make some kind of forecast as to what the problems are, and then to indicate that your solution is likely to be the better, at least, of the two which are being proposed by respective candidates or respective parties. There is a tendency, I think, in perhaps in politics everywhere, but certainly in the United States, in the course of a campaign to somewhat oversimplify when passing judgment upon politicians or upon political parties or upon administrations, and to hold them responsible not only for what they've done or for what they should have done, but also to hold them responsible for everything that has happened in the course of their term in office. And on the other hand, a tendency, it doesn't quite balance out, I'm sure, to take credit for everything good that happens while one is in office or while one's party is in office. There is this problem, a difficult one for citizens, I think, to make the distinctions that are necessary to decide, in the first place, what government is truly responsible for, and then to decide as best we can in what measure government or public office holders have carried out that responsibility or who have met the demands of the situation. There's some consolation for us who are called politicians in reflections such as the one which Christopher Dawson makes in his book on Understanding Europe, when he says that the politicians are not responsible for the present world crisis. This was 5 or 6 years ago. He says it's rather the scientists and the technicians and the philosophers and the theologians and the men of letters who have played the larger part in producing the changes in culture which ultimately have led to the present world problems. Dawson, of course, as you know, is a philosopher and an historian and a man of ideas. And I think they sometimes, too, are inclined to give themselves too much credit or too much blame. But in any case, he goes on to say that the politicians are somewhat handicapped in their attempt to deal with problems such as we face, which are the product in a large measure of the culture of the past and of the culture of our own time, in that he says the politicians cannot be expected to look very deeply into the past or very far into the future. And of course, when I recall this statement by Dawson, I was somewhat taken aback at having accepted an assignment to talk on the task ahead. I'll try not to undertake to look too far beyond the limitations which I assume Dawson would set for most men who hold public office. But he did more or less give us a kind of duty of office, I suppose, accepting our limitations, in that he said that since the primary responsibility for action rests with the politicians rather than with the philosophers and the scientists, the politicians are expected to explain what is happening and why it is happening, and then to do something about it. It is necessary to have some understanding of what has gone before and of the elements and factors in our culture in order to make even reasonably good political decisions. The problems of our age are a reflection of our total culture and reflect the movement of history also. It is therefore obvious that a mere change of men or a mere change of parties or even a change of political policy, because political policy in democratic society at most changes very slowly, that these cannot immediately cure us of all of our difficulties or eliminate all of our problems. The responsibility rests with every person, with every institution, family, church, school, business, press, the community, all of these institutions and persons that have some degree of power in forming the mind and will of the people. In a pluralistic society such as ours, there will be inevitably a much overlapping and a great sharing, a mutual sharing of responsibility among persons and among institutions. Clear distinctions, as we know, cannot always be drawn. We cannot easily say that this is the responsibility of this institution as distinguished from another, or of this person because of his special office as distinguished from some other person who holds a different office. The first task, I suppose, of a legislator, task which he faces after taking public office, is to determine the areas in which government has responsibility, responsibility to act in order to advance the common good. This is not an easy distinction for a legislator to make. It's not an easy distinction for anyone to make. There's been a great deal of talk within the last year or two, and particularly since the first satellite was launched on October 4th, 1957, to the effect that we live in a new era, that October 4th signaled the beginning of a new age, and that we had to work now in a new dimension. One commentator went so far as to say that the problems of mankind must now be considered as differing in a qualitative sense from his earlier problems, and that we had entered into an age which required a new philosophy, a new theology, new political, new economic and social forms, and new political procedures, as well as new programs. Of course, the advance in nuclear physics and the launching of satellites and space rockets, these things do call for some new thought and some new action. But no one of them necessarily sets up a conflict with sound philosophy or with sound theology. Or do they necessarily call for drastic changes in social, economic, and political organization and procedure? What they do require is a greater response, an acceptance of a greater challenge, and of course this response, in part at least, must be political. We must ask ourselves this question, taking into account these changes and other changes that have taken place, whether government should play a larger part or a somewhat smaller part, a greater or a lesser part in the immediate future. And of course, when this question is raised, we immediately get oversimplified answers, I think, on both sides. Those who say that we have too much government and that the best thing for us all would be to have government get out of business and out of science and almost to have it get out of government. And those, on the other hand, who say that the only response is to have government extend its power and its authority. And there are those who recommend something in between, or at least who call for a careful examination and for careful distinctions. Peter Drucker, in a book which has been but recently published, asserts that the increase in the size of government, which concerns so many people, is not necessarily accompanied by an increase or an intensification of its power, and that the simple extension of government into new fields is not necessarily, in consequence, indicate that government is doing too much or that government is even doing the things that we could properly expect it to do. In fact, of course, mere size can lead to inefficiency and to ineffectiveness, an inability to exercise decisive authority when and where it is needed. If government tries to become too responsible, or responsible for too many things, we may find ourselves in a position where government undertakes to do things which could better be reserved for other groups of society. But we should note that oftentimes that this action, which is called an intrusion or usurpation, is not that the motivation, that the force for it does not come from government itself, but comes in consequence of neglect on the part of other governmental institutions or government at other levels, or it comes because at the level of local government, new problems have arisen which cannot be fully met by the institutions which exist. I could cite some two or three special problems that have arisen within the last 10 years. The problem of government in the suburbs, for example, outside incorporated metropolitan areas. The problem of metropolitan airports commissions and of sanitary districts and all of the other regional and at least any those comprehending any area beyond one which is now included in an organized governmental unit. But there's been very little response at the local level, and very little response or inclination on the part of states, for example, to give up some of their jurisdiction so that somewhat more comprehensive and more effective regional organization within the United States can be effected. In the same way as we have been slow to give up jurisdiction and limited sovereignty in international relations, the same kind of hesitation, the same kind of delay is manifest within the government and among the governments of the United States itself. And we should note, too, that in our society that big government or government is not the only force which has grown somewhat larger and somewhat more powerful within recent years. It may be only the political counterpart of other big and powerful groups in society. And accepting totalitarian states, government remains in a large measure subordinate to these other power centers. In the United States, for example, we must recognize that industry, labor, our system of communications and finance, these are all powerful agencies which do exert political influence and political power. And that in addition to these, which are largely outside of government in a formal sense, that power centers can develop within a government itself, which begin to exert a kind of separate political power and to lead a kind of separate political life. And certainly in the United States, the one agency or department in which this kind of growth has taken place is that of the Department of Defense itself. We've not quite reached the point where the Congress has to negotiate with the Department of Defense, but in any case, it must be recognized that the Department of Defense is a great and powerful force, a political force in the government of the United States and consequently in the United States itself. And of course, these facts all raise very particular problems for those who are interested in government, and beyond that, for every citizen who takes his responsibility as a citizen seriously. So our problem is to determine which areas properly belong to government, to determine which level of government should take major responsibility, to determine those areas in which common cause must be made, and then, of course, to make as clearly as we can the distinction between those areas in which government has responsibility and the right and the need to operate and those which can much better be kept outside the influence and beyond the authority and the power of governmental institutions. A far better criterion than the size of government, a criterion for measurement, is that of trying to determine the positive ways in which government protects and advances human dignity and human freedom. Such a concept may call for increased government activity in some cases, and it may call for a gradual withdrawal or a gradual lessening of government activity in other cases. In other words, it's not the mere size of the governmental agency or institution or the government itself, But whether the size, whatever it may be, and the power, whatever it may be, is truly being used to promote human welfare and what we, in rather sweeping language, call the common good. This is not an easy distinction to make, and many men of goodwill differ as to where the line should be drawn, as to where the authority should be applied, and as to where it should be withdrawn. I will undertake to talk about some three or four areas in which government does have a very particular kind of responsibility, and then to try to draw, if I can, or establish the limits of that responsibility. We talk quite freely in the United States of the concern of the government for human rights, and we tend to have rather specific rights in mind when we use this terminology. As a matter of fact, of course, the whole concern of government is with human rights. And I suppose that everything that is done in the name of government, we could say eventually and ultimately and fundamentally and basically, is directed to the advancement of human rights and of justice, of providing greater opportunity for individuals to achieve perfection, or at least the freedom which is necessary in order that they can move towards perfection. In a more specific way, we do have a special problem in this area in the United States. And this is one of the tasks which lie ahead. There has been one great failing, I suppose, a great weakness, a kind of lethargy to a certain extent, and positive opposition along with that, to the extension of equal rights to minorities, principally to racial minorities in the United States. Negroes, Indians, Spanish Americans, and those of Oriental origin. This is the principal area. I should say this is not a matter which is of concern only because it affects our foreign policy. It's a matter of basic concern to everyone who seeks to extend justice to all people. But certainly it is a particular concern today, since it is the principal area in which we in the United States are on trial before more than two-thirds of the people of the world who are non-Caucasians. We know that much has been done, but of course much remains to be done. And while government cannot directly touch the inner conscience of individuals who are prejudiced, it can and should guarantee equality in the external relationships which have public significance and public overtones. And these include educational opportunity, employment on the basis of ability, access to housing, and guarantees of equality before the law in legal processes. It would, of course, be a mistake to assume that the civil rights program is exclusively a question of racial minority groups. When we speak of human rights, we include much more than what in popular language we mean when we refer to civil rights. Human rights are surely involved in a number of other problems which are the concern of government. Question of living conditions and substandard housing, problems of the care of the aged, of health, educational opportunities, of working conditions, and even of property rights. All of these are matters directly involved in the exercise and the enjoyment of human rights. In a highly industrialized and extremely mobile society such as ours, the old institutions which protected the dignity and the security of individuals no longer are effective, or at least they're not effective in the same degree. Throughout the whole history of the United States, emphasis has been placed upon private ownership. It was held that man could not be truly free unless he had a measure of economic security. And certainly for the first 100 years of the existence of our country, this security could best be attained through private ownership. Thomas Jefferson, among the founding fathers, first described this dream as a situation in which everyone would be independent, the owner of productive property and land. And this same idea was continued, of course, and incorporated in the Homestead Act in the middle of the 19th century. And along with this freedom through the ownership of land was the dream of the working man who owned his own shop, or the merchant who owned his own store. Well, the reality today, of course, is quite different. Most Americans do not own productive property, and this constitutes a basic problem for government. And that minority which does retain direct and effective ownership has ownership which is greatly watered down. Obviously, in the case of those who hold stocks in corporations, they are two or three steps removed from the effective exercise of the rights of property in the direction of their industry. Many others hold a title which is clouded by a mortgage. This is productive property. But even in the field of consumer goods, there's been a significant change, and this change has occurred most drastically within the last 15 or 20 years. As we moved into a credit economy, which includes not only productive property, but also consumer goods. The ownership of homes, for example. When we begin to talk in terms of 40-year mortgages, the notion of direct and positive ownership, such as our parents, for example, had in mind, must be drastically changed. More and more, we've come not really to own, but to purchase the use of both producer and consumer goods. Houses, cars, appliances, even vacations we can buy in advance. It's somewhat like anticipating Vespers. You get a day ahead of yourself, eventually. We pay not only rent, but as in times past, but we have a new kind of rent in the way of interest. So that insofar as the ownership of productive property and in a large measure of consumer property, we've moved around to a situation in which we have something much like that which existed in the early medieval times, when a man held a right to work or a right to certain goods, but in return for that, he paid rent. We pay either rent or interest. And I say this change and this fact does create a problem for government. It creates social problems. It creates serious economic problems. Under such conditions, then, government has a new kind of obligation. At least it must operate in a different way, and its function is the protector of the rights and the freedom of individuals and of institutions. Many of the programs which have been critically labeled as a part of the welfare state are necessary for this purpose. The effect is not to make individual citizens serfs to the government, but properly conceived and executed, it may serve to set them free from the government as well as from economic forces which are operative in our society. Many of the early critics of the Social Security program, are beginning to accept now that the establishment of this program actually leaves employees somewhat more free than they would be if they were tied exclusively to a private company pension plan, which have the effect oftentimes of tying the employee to a particular job in a particular industry and making it extremely difficult for him to exercise the choice or to make a decision to move on to something else. It's my opinion that we must take something of the same view with regard to insurance, health insurance programs, or retirement insurance programs, whether they be initiated by the government or whether they be on a purely voluntary basis. These have great significance in terms of the measure of freedom which the individual may in the future enjoy. In any case, making use of some kind of mass coverage not only as an economic justification in some cases, but it can very well also have the effect of giving to the citizen a freedom which he would not otherwise possess. We must, of course, keep in mind there's a vast difference between the welfare state program proposed by Karl Marx, and this is usually the one which we're asked to answer for, and that which has been proposed by prudent men in democratic society. Even such men as Pope Pius XII, who outlined a 5 or 6 point program, which had it come from someone else, might have been very widely criticized. Ordinarily, of course, it is charged that programs of this kind, once they have started, are bound to go too far. And no one can answer this charge excepting on the basis of the record. We look to what has happened in this country and what has happened in other countries. And I think the only fair conclusion that we can come to at this point, at least, is to say that this charge and this argument has not very well been substantiated. Actually, examined in the light of Christian social principles, the program, the welfare program in the United States, seems to be well within limits of what can be considered reasonable and perhaps even somewhat short of desirable goals. Our minimum wage law, for example, is certainly modest, and we do not yet have an effective federal Fair Employment Practices Act. Protection for migratory farm workers scarcely exists in the United States, and what we really have only in consequence of the Mexican governments having insisted on reasonable standards for the Mexican nationalists who came to this country. Agriculture is still a high-risk and a low-income occupation. The housing needs of the nation are really far from being adequately met. The Social Security program has been improved and broadened, but there remain great gaps in it also. And it's increasingly evident that the present unemployment compensation program, administered as it is in various ways by the 48 separate states, is inadequate to meet the demands placed upon it by extreme shifts in industry and by the highly mobile workforce that we have in the United States, as well as inadequate to meet even a limited kind of recession. There is, of course, daily demand for additional governmental aid, either federal or state, to our educational institutions. And all of these are areas in which government has a responsibility and therefore has some obligation to concern itself with the problem and, if it can work out a program, also to act. There's a third general field of action which I think will be of greater and greater concern to us in the future. It includes all of those activities which come under the general title of the democratic process. As you know, during the last few days, we've been debating the democratic process as it applies to the United States Senate. And we've had this rather unusual action that a majority of the Senate has indicated that they don't have confidence in a majority of the Senate, which is a strange kind of turnabout, at least not in the long run. Well, I don't mean to debate this particular proposition, but rather to say that this matter of democratic rule and of democratic processes is one which we tend all too often to think of as having significance and application only in governmental institutions. And of course it does have primary, at least in terms of the history of this United States, a kind of primary emphasis in that area. But I do think we must raise some questions about its application in other areas. We did in the last Congress attempt to pass legislation which it was believed would establish democratic rule within the labor movement, within the labor unions of the country. And this is certainly an acceptable extension. But I do believe we must give thought to the further extension of this, not so much the rule by majority, although it comes to that in most cases, but rather an acceptance on the part of the people in powerful organizations, institutions, that each one of them as a part of a potential majority has a responsibility to know and to understand, and a responsibility to participate in some measure in the decisions and the determinations of that institution or that organization. This applies in government institutions, but it applies also in economic organizations, in the labor movement, and it should be applied also in the great financial, in the great industrial institutions of this country, because we know that it's awfully hard to find a stockholder in a corporation who will admit that he has any real responsibility for the policies of that corporation. And we must, of course, give him full credit when he says that it's extremely difficult to exercise responsibility. But nonetheless, we must insist that he accept that he has, no matter how it may be watered down, no matter how finely divided, that there is there a measure of responsibility, and that it is a part of the problem of government and part of the problem and the responsibility of people who are concerned with keeping these institutions and making them truly effective and having the men who participate them in them carry out their moral responsibilities to work on the processes and to work on the procedures, because it's only through proper procedures that democratic institutions can be maintained and can be made to work effectively. Having the men who participate carry out their moral responsibilities to work on the processes and to work on the procedures, because it's only through proper procedures that democratic institutions can be maintained and can be made to work effectively. And beyond that, of course, beyond domestic problems, the problem of extending democratic processes into the field of international relations. The matter of foreign policy is, of course, always a most delicate one. It involves give and take. It requires us to act in an area in which we do not really have the same kind of effective authority and power that we do have in governmental institutions and governmental actions that are restricted to the field of domestic problems. There is a tendency among us to reject any concessions in the international area as though they represented a compromise of basic principle. Of course, none of us would be so naive as to say that the majority is always right, but we have to show a disposition, it seems to me, even beyond our own borders, to believe that reasonably informed people are less likely to be wrong, or at least that they will not be so wrong as a few individuals making these important decisions. This vigilance and concern for the democratic process in which members participate intelligently and actively is badly needed at every level of government, and I suppose nowhere more than in the areas of new political problems, in the suburbs and those areas which require reorganization and legal and governmental entities where none now exist. It is part of the genius of America that the democratic process has spread to other social institutions, from typical clubs and organizations and community life to the corporate form and to business organizations, and with almost every kind of social and economic and political life and institution we do have in the United States. And in some measure, the question of how well we respond in these other institutions is an indication of how well we respond in the great test of democratic government in the world conflict. Walter Lippmann, a true friend of democracy, has within the last year or two indicated increasing doubt as to whether the people of the free democracies of the Western world possess the necessary maturity of mind and of will to make the decisions which the times call for. I am, I think, somewhat more optimistic than he is, but no one can be altogether sure and satisfied that we do have this necessary maturity. This is the problem which requires the attention, continuous attention, of everyone. It's not merely a matter of willingness to make decisions, but preliminary to that, of a willingness to be informed, of a willingness to involve oneself, of a willingness to make decisions and to undertake the burdensome and sometimes very trivial and exasperating tasks that are necessary in order to make democratic institutions work. A fourth general area of problems and responsibility of the government is that of government intervention in the economic life of the country. Now, this is a topic, of course, on which books have been written and on which many speeches have been made. But if we accept this basic fact that government alone at the present time has a debt of some $280 billion, the federal government alone, that it collects and spends approximately $80 billion a year, and that it has responsibility under the Constitution for safeguarding the currency, and many other responsibilities beyond that, it's a simple matter of fact that government policy in the field of the direction of the economic affairs and the fiscal affairs of this country is vitally important. The President, in his State of the Union message the other day, made reference to the Full Employment Act of 1946, and he emphasized the special responsibilities drawn from that act with regard to inflation, and this is certainly an area of responsibility. But that same act also states that it is the responsibility of the government to provide full employment. This was an aspect of it which was not given so much attention in the State of the Union message. But it is nonetheless a responsibility which does rest upon the government, not upon the government alone, but as other institutions more and more put off their responsibility, as they put more and more emphasis upon, as they sometimes say, their one objective, namely that of making money for their stockholders or for their owners, whoever they may be, then some institution or some person or some other agency must take that responsibility, or the institution, the original one, must accept a greater measure of responsibility. And we are in the United States in a kind of in-between position on this problem, in which policies and programs must be worked out, in which the whole question of responsibility and of the incidence of that responsibility must be greatly clarified. It's not just a matter of judgment, of intellectual judgment, but also a question of establishing moral responsibility and of having that moral responsibility accepted. There's a fifth area of, I suppose, of growing concern to all of us. And this is the matter of communication and the whole field of ideas and the institutions and the actions that are performed, the operations whereby the people of this country are educated not only in formal institutions, but educated and developed in some measure in their leisure time. The problem of automation and its effect upon the working force has an accompanying problem with regard to the proper use of leisure time. And I think we'd accept that on the record that not even the aristocracies of the past or the present have really worked out the problem of how best to spend your leisure time. And if many people have leisure time, then there does develop a social responsibility to attend to the problem of how this leisure time is spent and in what manner people exercise themselves during their leisure time. We'd be glad to say that we ought to let other institutions and government take this responsibility. But when we've not quite reached it, but there's a possibility that we reach a point where all of these institutions are closely controlled and closely held, then the question arises as to who is the censor and who directs the program and who decides what should be performed and what should be taught and what the people should actually be exposed to. I say this is an area into which we must move most carefully, but nonetheless it's one which I think we must look to as creating new problems and new responsibilities in the future. And of course there is the one final great area of international responsibility in a foreign policy. And I do not mean to go into any detail on that, but simply to make this one point, namely that the foreign policy of the United States has historically pursued really four main objectives. One, that of preserving our own territorial integrity and the lifelines to necessary resources, a kind of physical protection of the United States. Secondly, the objective of preserving our national honor, and this was something which was much easier to do in the 19th century than it is in the 20th century. Third, the objective of protecting and preserving Western civilization, which at least in part took us into two world wars. And finally, an obligation which has been accepted somewhat positively only since World War II, of undertaking to do something in the name of justice for people of other civilizations, of other races, of other cultures than our own. A kind of comprehensive acknowledgement that we have a responsibility to all peoples in all parts of the world. And this obligation, I think, was best expressed in a speech by Henry Spock, the secretary of the NATO organization, quite recently, in which he said that this is a responsibility which the United States must share with all of the peoples of Western civilization. And he said it's a responsibility which cannot be met by any one nation separately. But if we're going to meet it adequately, we must meet it, as he said, all together. And he went on to say that this obligation does really not know any limits, but it really extends as far as we can effectively exercise any responsibility. These are general objectives and the purposes which our foreign policy must seek. And of course, in the pursuit of them, we realize that many hard and many difficult decisions must be made. We are involved in what has been described as a total challenge. And I hesitate to say that this is just a challenge which is issued to us by the communists, although they have made it most clear and most certain, of course. But it's a challenge which we could very well face even though there were no communist movement or communist conspiracy. One which we might very well face if we had only to deal with the rising concern of many people throughout the world with their own poverty and ignorance and with their own oppression, with their own sad plight. But it's somewhat easier for us to talk about this challenge because it has been formulated, it has been stated, it has been laid down before us by spokesmen for the communist movement. And this challenge is so complete that we cannot really say that we have met it adequately, even though we prove that our philosophy is superior to that of others, or that our economic system is more productive, if we are able to prove that, or that our educational system produces better scientists and technologists than does any other educational system, or that our form of political organization or our general culture is superior. We might prove each one of these to our own satisfaction, yet lose the case. What we are called upon to do is to take all of these things together and to prove that our total way of life provides the best way and the best hope of mankind in his efforts to achieve a fuller measure of justice and happiness and a greater opportunity for self-realization and perfection. As we face this challenge as Americans and citizens of the United States, we must, I think, acknowledge that we suffer from a special kind of disability, a persistent belief in the basic innocence and righteousness of Americans. This is a belief which has agitated the American mind, well, really from the time of the colonial settlements. According to the concept, we accept that as inhabitants of a new land, people living under a new government, we were somehow set aside from the movement of history and from tradition, and somehow unmarked. R.W.B. Lewis described us as believing that we lived in a condition of natural goodness, a kind of modified pre-fall condition in which we did not clearly know good or evil. Under this theory, as applied to politics, of course, it was not considered wise to call upon the American people for self-examination or for self-criticism, or to call upon the citizens to take any responsibility for the failure of government, either in judgment or in the execution of policy, even though the fact might have been that the failure was in consequence of a direct response to some kind of popular pressure or popular demand. We need to impress upon every citizen that since each has power, each of them must in some measure be wise, therefore have some understanding of the problems and a measure of properly formed will with regard to those problems. And to accept that this is a responsibility really which we cannot limit to this particular problem, to a local problem, to a problem of the United States, one which goes beyond our external borders. The real fact is that this struggle for power is one in which we are involved. We cannot stand aside passing moral judgments and watching the shifting in the balance of power as we could in the 19th century. We must accept that we too are in the scales. The choices which we are called upon to make are not, we are sure now, going to be simple ones between that which is altogether right and that which is altogether wrong. The kind of choices which the attitude of innocence would lead us to like to make. These simple choices between that which is clearly right and that which is clearly wrong are seldom offered, even in domestic politics, and we know even less often are they given to us in international affairs. More often the choice is in a kind of uncertain and rather vague and shifting area. And in this situation, the sense of innocence and a vague moral idealism and a kind of unfounded optimism, these are not sure foundations upon which we can stand against the irrational and evil forces which are abroad. This challenge of today can be met only by a fully mature response, a response which involves, in the first place, our giving somewhat more attention to our basic philosophy, to our basic beliefs. It is not merely enough for us to declare for freedom and to say freedom is wonderful and good for all of us. We must be ready and able to explain why we believe in it and to establish the justification for our claims. It is not enough for us to talk rather glibly and quickly and readily of the dignity of man, but we must be prepared to explain the origin of that dignity and in what it consists. Philosophy and religious beliefs are a part of our total way as much as political theory. Political institutions and political processes, however, cannot be neglected. Educational institutions, the family, business and financial organizations, labor unions, the media of communication, our whole culture itself, none of these can be set aside or apart and reserved for the future. In short, the task ahead for the United States is a total task involving a total challenge, one which can be met only by a total response. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator, for your very stimulating talk. A question period will now follow. If you have a question, raise your hand, wait until you are recognized, and then please arise and speak just as loudly as possible. We don't ask you to rise and speak loud because we want to make you conspicuous or anything, but we do want to hear you, and we want everyone in the audience to hear the question to avoid unnecessary repetition.
Well, I have a comprehensive tax revision program. Of course, the Democrats like to say we ought to stimulate the economy so that we can draw more taxes from increased production. That's the easy political answer, you know. And I think there's some potential in that. But I would say that we can impose additional taxes even on the current income without seriously, it wouldn't really change our whole civilization. I'm glad you started out with a question of that kind. I was going to say I didn't want you to hesitate. You didn't really have to stay with the text or within reach of the text, that you could ask any question you wanted to, that after 10 years in the House, you're supposed to be able to either answer a question or avoid it. So we'd be willing to have you come on any relatively, a question that's reasonably within order. Well, I would say that it's advantageous for them to have a knowledge of technology, since we may, as we move into new procedures of government, really, such as a Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, that certainly in cases of that kind, some knowledge of technology and of the science involved is important. But at the same time, I would say that that kind of knowledge is really secondary in a legislative branch and in an executive branch of the government. In the policy-making offices, then is a knowledge of history and a knowledge of philosophy and of the other disciplines. It would be secondary, I would say. Yes, sir. Well, of course, some of us accept that it is necessary under certain circumstances, and that really the question of an increase in the national debt is one which is related to other considerations than the simple one of whether or not the budget is balanced. I think all of us would agree that if the deficit were to run as high in the next three or four fiscal years, or even the next two or three, as it did in the last, that this would be a matter of serious concern to the country and that fiscal instability would be clearly manifest. But an increase of $1 billion or $1.5 billion, if accompanied by a reasonable expansion of productivity, this is not a serious matter. And that a national debt such as we have of $280 billion with a gross national product which moves on towards $500 billion a year, that this in itself would not necessarily be a serious matter in the long run. It might be in the short span of 5 years or 10 years. What we seem not to accept is that whereas many of our major industries are run on credit almost entirely, that when we move from this area to government, that then somehow this becomes an immoral act. I was pretty nearly run out. Well, it wasn't quite that, but there was great shock silence. I talked to a credit men's association one day, and I began my speech by saying that I was certainly happy to have an audience that was unanimously in favor of deficit financing. And there was a great silence until I had to explain that I was trying to be funny. But this is not limited to people like that, businessmen who are trying to borrow money themselves to run their own business in anticipation of greater returns, will, if in the face of a government deficit, even though we anticipate greater productivity and expanded activity, we just fail to make the transfer. Well, let me see now. We voted four or five times today. My final vote was for the 2/3 of those present, but that came only after I'd voted for 3/5 and for a simple majority. And this involves the whole concept of what the United States Senate really is in our structure of government. And I could not accept the argument that through this device of a 2/3 rule on closing off debate, that the men who drafted the Constitution intended that minority should be protected. The minority protection, which was intended to be secured through the United States Senate, was that of giving each state 2 senators, no matter how small they might be, and that this was a further extension of it. And that actually we have in our government, I think, a reasonable system of checks and balances without the 2/3 rule for closing off debate in the Senate. Since you have the House vote and you have the veto and you have the final appeal to the Supreme Court if a constitutional question is involved, and that this protection, it seemed to me, was something more than was necessary. The further argument was made, of course, that the Senate was a great body for the information of the public and for full discussion of issues. And it was my opinion that the provisions in the amendments which were offered adequately took care of this particular proposition, that the ready talk about the Senate as a great deliberative body, that you deliberate only in anticipation of action, and that the proposition they made would have continued it simply in the act of deliberation, and you'd never get on to the action itself. But this is an area in which prudent men can disagree, and it may be necessary to refine democracy to a point of saying that, and we do have it in the Constitution, saying that the majority, the simple majority, should not always act. But this was one area in which it was my opinion that neither the Constitution nor the current facts, justify anything more than a majority action. Well, I wouldn't necessarily say the government. We're saying that it should be extended to the member of the labor union, and I say that the other is much more difficult than that. But what we do have is a general failure. Now, actually, there have been some rather, I'd say, encouraging or interesting developments in the corporate field in which stockholders have moved in. Generally, when they move in, it's not because of any concern with the morality or immorality of the general policies of the company, but because they don't think they're making enough money. But you might very well have them move on some other issue of how the company was treating its working men, for example, or perhaps more importantly on the issue of whether or not the company was serving the common good. This could quite properly be a matter of concern to stockholders. Let us assume that the U.S. Steel says that if we operate at 60% of capacity or 65% of capacity, we can make more money. But the common good would be better served if we operated at 85 or 90% of capacity. Well, now, who has the primary responsibility for making this decision to operate at 85 or 90% of capacity rather than 65% of capacity? We'd say that if you want to really preserve a kind of responsible free enterprise system, that the people who own the corporation should make that decision. And if they do, why, that's fine. If they don't, then you reach a point where you say, well, there must be some kind of public intervention here for the good of the whole. Now, these are areas in which we may have to face decisions and take some kind of governmental action, especially as corporations become larger and larger and exercise some of you may have read Mill's book on the power elite, in which he says that really all the big decisions in this country are made by a kind of agreement between the military establishment and the great corporations, and that Congress is really just this kind of a sideshow. And the executive branch of the government, in some measure, is the same. Well, this is an overstatement of his position, and I think his position is something of an overstatement. But when this does become true, we're two steps removed from the facts, probably. But to the degree that this is the way that things are moving, then you have to accept that at some point, if the general welfare is not properly recognized, someone must step in and say, this is the way you must operate this business.
Could you suggest some possible ways in which the government might facilitate democracy in this respect?
Well, I think we've moved ahead in the field of the labor movement, for example. This is an act on the part of the federal government to at least give some assurance and establish at least the opportunity for a democratic handling of the affairs of the labor movement.
I especially like the problem of the stockholding.
Well, I don't have a specific proposal to make on that point. The machinery is there for them. We might require that they be consulted in somewhat more detailed way than they are generally consulted. I just say that this is an area when there is a concentration of power of this kind, and when the people responsible for it fail to exercise it or have difficulty in exercising. And this was a part of the problem in the labor movement. It wasn't that they were altogether unwilling. In some cases, it was a matter of a difficulty of exercising it. But then a government action which makes it easier for them to exercise their to carry out their responsibility, this is clearly defensible and may be necessary. I don't have a bill in to take care of the problem of the common stockholders right now, though.
Senator Cotton, you were very
Well, I don't know as that we need new institutions necessarily, excepting that this relates to the separation of people from effective control over productive goods. That the question of security then begins to rest in other titles to ownership, although it's not ownership of productive property. And we may very well, you've had some proposals made with regard to the transfer of houses. This is usually done on a local level, but this may relate to it. We've moved into the very slowly into the automobile field in the last Congress, in which we went so far as to require that the dealers post the charges for the automobile and itemize whether you were how much you were paying for the foam rubber cushions and how much for the automatic transmission. That the question of security then begins to rest in other titles to ownership, although it's not ownership of productive property. And we may very well, you've had some proposals made with regard to the transfer of houses. This is usually done on a local level, but this may relate to it. We've moved into the very slowly into the automobile field in the last Congress, in which we went so far as to require that the dealers post the charges for the automobile and itemize whether you were how much you were paying for the foam rubber cushions and how much for the automatic transmission. This was a very very slight move, but I suppose since we accept now that every American has an automobile, that this then becomes a matter of social concern. And of course, if the Lincoln Continental had taken hold back in 1955 when they were going to make everybody a king by giving him a Lincoln or having him buy a Lincoln Continental, this problem would be greatly simplified. But since the Continental failed, why, we're not quite ready for that kind of standardization, evidently. The recognition of them? Well, I think this is a question of prudence. This is not, you recognize them. The best example, I suppose, we could say is that in the time of the Crusades, there were certain Christian countries which finally recognized, for all practical purposes, the countries which were controlled by the Saracens. This becomes a question of a practical question, a question of prudence, whether it's better to do so for any of a number of reasons than it is not to do so. And it's not a question of liberal versus conservative or Democrat versus Republican. It becomes a hard practical question. I think you have to face each one on the basis of a particular recommendation.
Excuse me, we'll have time for two more questions.
That's right. Well, I expect that we'll be able to pass something very much like it, and that we probably will pass something very similar to it. I doubt that we'll go much beyond it. Been better, I feel, if we had passed it in the last Congress, so we'd have some experience with it, but I think that there was enough in it to deserve a try. And you have the other consideration, namely, that the merger of the AFL and the CIO has now moved to a point where one can, and the Teamsters have in some measure declined, or at least the others have gained sufficient strength, so that you might fairly argue that they ought to be given a chance to discipline themselves, and that Kennedy Ives would make, at least it would open up the area and would give them, leave them without any very good excuse. One more. Well, I assume that if the Defense Department comes up and makes a case for it, that it will probably be extended, and undoubtedly there may be a move to revise it in some respects, but I would say generally that support the extension of it. I think this is what will happen.
Thank you very much, Senator. May I thank all of you who showed up tonight, and I would also like to especially thank Those friendly faces, at least I thought they were friendly, who I saw at every lecture this season. I hope you come back next season when they're sure to have put on a very fine lecture. And I'd like to also especially thank my very fine committee, which has helped me this year. Thank you again. Good night.